This episode is dedicated to the memory of Gary Shandling, who passed away suddenly last week. While there are many people I admire, few have impacted me the way Gary Shandling did as a comedian, as a storyteller, and as a wise, brilliant, patient, listening man. He absolutely altered comedy and television at least twice, once with It's the Gary Shandling Show, and again with my all-time favorite TV series, The Larry Sanders Show. I never met him, I never knew him, but through his work, in a way, I did. Gary Shandling was a treasure, and he 100% shaped me in some way. And I'm certainly not alone, as you've seen by the tributes that came pouring in. So I say, in my own little way, Gary Shandling, I will miss you. Thank you for being here. You changed things. You may now flip. Massey Hall and Roy Thompson Hall proudly present huge events in Toronto over the next 2 months. April Fool's, an evening of comedy at Massey Hall, hosted by Gilbert Gottfried, with headliner Nikki Payne, takes place at Massey Hall on Friday, April 1st at 8 p.m. And, of course, Creative Control with Vish Khanna. Hey, that's me. That's this show. We're doing a live taping with the Minotaurs and an interview with that band's Nathan Lohr, as well as a conversation with CBC Radio's Pia Chattopadhyay. That's happening at the Drake Underground on Saturday, April 9th at 8 p.m. For more details about physical accessibility and to purchase tickets to any of these events, please visit roythompson.com or masseyhall.com.
This week, the Bookshelf Cinema is screening Brooklyn, Where to Invade Next, Half the Sky Part 2, Predator, The Lady in the Van, The Revenant, Coming Home, and more. The Bookshelf is an independently owned cultural hub located at 41 Quebec Street in Guelph, Ontario. For more information about the Bookshelf's hours, listings, blogs, directions, and accessibility, please visit bookshelf.ca.
This episode is brought to you by Pizza Trocadero, the finest pizzeria in all of Guelph, Ontario. They've got delicious gourmet pizzas, or choose from an array of fresh ingredients and make whatever you like. Calzones, wings, panzerotti, salads, breadsticks, garlic bread. Pizza Trocadero has it all. You can find them at 7 Municipal Street in Guelph, or visit them online at trocaderoguelph.ca. That's TrocaderoGuelph.ca. Call them at 519-829-2444 for pickup or delivery. That's Pizza Trocadero, a place of the good trade.
Creative Control with Vish Khanna.
Casey is the lead singer and songwriter in an acclaimed American rock band called Proto Martyr. Formed in Detroit in 2008, Proto Martyr have released 3 full-length albums, including their well-received breakthrough, The Agent Intellect, which came out via Hardly Art Records in October 2015. The band has been touring almost nonstop since then, including upcoming Canadian dates in Guelph, Ottawa, Montreal, and Calgary throughout May and June. Here now to discuss some of these things is Joe Casey of Proto Martyr. Hi, Joe. How are you?
I'm doing good.
That's good to hear. Where are you?
I'm in my home in Detroit right now.
How are things in Detroit?
Pretty good. We just got back from a very long tour, so I'm loving it. It's nice to be back home. And the weather's not too bad. It's just a little chilly, but nothing you can't deal with.
Now, how was your tour? Did you play places you hadn't played before?
Yeah, a few different. We went all the way down to Florida. Last time we toured, we just went to just like the top of it. We went all the way down to Miami and all the way back. We really like circled all of America and then went up to Vancouver and then back to Detroit. So got to see it all. Fargo, North Dakota, we played there too.
I went to see Bob Dylan in Fargo, North Dakota.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah, and I went to the Blockbuster video there, and I asked them if Fargo was a popular rental, and they said no.
No, yeah.
They don't like the movie there.
Yeah, because there's only that one scene at the very beginning that takes place in Fargo, so I'm sure they're just...
That's what she said. She said, it's stupid. It doesn't even take place in Fargo. It's just the one scene, and now everyone comes and they think blah, 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 blah. Anyway, it was a good show. He played a baseball diamond.
Oh, nice.
And I've never seen, I don't know if you're a fan, but I'd never seen him. They were just having fun. I saw a bunch of shows. I just happened to work out that my friend and I went and saw a few shows. And that one, they just did stuff they don't normally do and they were giggling. There's something, do you prefer playing outdoors or indoors? Do you have a preference?
I like outdoors at night, but that's very rare for us. Usually we're playing during the day. And I prefer indoors, I'd say. I mean, I'm a smoker, so I like being outdoors because then I can smoke on stage. But, yeah, I guess I prefer indoors.
It's kind of weird because the sound will dissipate when you're outdoors. It just sort of vanishes in the air.
Yeah, and it really, you can actually hear, like, the crowd a lot more if they're talking. It's very, yeah. I don't know. I can give up smoking for an hour. So, yeah, I guess indoors is fine.
Right, right. Now, as we're speaking, your state of Michigan, your governor, Rick Snyder, and your neighbors in Flint have been in the news because of the water crisis and the alleged corruption that brought them there. What is your take on what's happening in Michigan? I'm just curious if you have one.
Well, I've got kind of an insider's take, I think, because my dad, who's passed away, he used to work for the Detroit Water Department, and he was a construction inspector there. And he always said for the longest time that, you know, once people moved out of Detroit and, you know, there was this great exodus, the first thing they wanted to do was wrest control of the water department from Detroit, you know, the suburbs. Because, you know, Detroit pumps water all the way to Flint, and Flint is very far away. So it's kind of expensive, you know, out in the suburbs to get this clean Detroit water. And so they've been, you know, the city or the state government has been coming up with schemes for years about how to wrest that control away. And their new scheme, or the scheme they've been working on for years, actually, is to build a new water plant farther up north. And, you know, they can't get people to join onto this water system until they get it finished, but when they have this emergency manager rule where they can put, you know, government lackeys in control of poor cities, then they can just kind of force them to join up to the system.
Right.
And so that's what they did, and it was mostly a screw you to Detroit, even though Detroit was going to lower, you know, the cost of water just to keep Flint using the water. They said, oh, we'll just use this dirty river. And, oh, we actually don't know how to pump water or don't have the expertise, and so they just poisoned a bunch of people. And it was basically just, you know, a political move. And now they're trying to pretend like they didn't know. But they knew and they didn't care because Flint's a poor city.
Now, so. Are you saying then that your father predicted that this sort of thing might happen?
Well, yeah, it definitely went, well, and it's also kind of tied in because they were mad at Detroit for years, and then we had a mayor, Kwame Kilpatrick, that I, you know, the first time he ran for office, I voted for him because he was a young guy, but he was pretty corrupt, and when my dad was working at the water department, he put in a guy named Mercado in charge of the water department, and immediately all of Kwame's cronies were getting, like, bids on contracts much higher than, like, other people, and so they're getting a lot of, like, free money from the water department because Mercado was Kwame's buddy and all this kind of thing. And my dad was like, okay, this is no good, because his job was actually to figure out how to pay people for work done on projects. Right. And so all of a sudden he was getting superseded, and like his whole office was getting superseded by the boss saying, oh, no, just pay them all they want. And he predicted that this was like, for the longest time, the water department was very clean and kind of separate from Detroit politics, and it kind of got drawn in by Kwame. And he says that's the nail that's going to be the thing where they're really going to try to take control away from Detroit. And here we are now where they're, you know, trying to build this new water system and poisoning people. So it's all kind of connected in a weird conspiracy-laden way. But
well, it doesn't sound conspiratorial. It sounds like it's quite, you know...
Yeah, it's pretty clear-cut, really.
Now, is this kind of deregulated trauma, basically, is that normal for the people of Michigan? You don't seem that surprised that this occurred. Again, you have your dad's inside scoop, but is this normal?
Well, the main thing is Michigan is mostly run at the state level by Republicans, and they're... answer for everything is like privatization, and you know, these poor cities can't take care of themselves, you know. And it's true, like Detroit does have its own share of corruption and problems, but they think, okay, well, we're going to get this businessman in and he's going to solve problems, and it doesn't get any better, except, you know, now we don't have like a vote, you know. It's not an elected official, but you know, we had like an emergency manager for a while, and now we actually have an elected mayor. But you know, they have these programs where, like, they're defunding the schools and things. Like, the Detroit school system is terrible. I mean, it's been terrible for years and years. And the fixes are like, oh, we'll open more charter schools and more of these, like, for-profit right. schools. And that doesn't really solve the problem at all. It's just to kind of take away, rights of people to vote in people that they want to run, you know, public schools.
What do you suppose it is about the mentality either of people from Michigan? I mean, we're seeing it on a larger scale in the States right now. At least I'm observing it from up here. We're all observing it around the world. There's a deferral to businessmen when it comes to political decision making. I don't know where this stems from within the psyche of your country or the people. Obviously, it's different from state to state, but that's kind of an odd impulse. To be like, these politicians are corrupt and don't know what they're doing. Let's get in a business guy, even though the businessmen's right. histories could be equally, if not more, checkered. Why is that a thing? Why do you think that people are so willing to trust a businessman over a politician that they view as potentially more crooked?
Well, I think it's... I don't know what it is. I think it's just because we have such this... belief in the capitalist system that we assume that the people that are the masters of capital make money, so they, you know, they can make us money, you know. And that's really not how government works, you know, as far as I know. I'm no expert on this kind of thing, but it just seems like we kind of throw our lot in, like, oh, you know, politicians are corrupt, businessmen, they're always looking for the bottom line, and if we get them on our side, then they'll look for the bottom line for us, you know, to help us out. But, you know, if you make a businessman, give him a job that a politician has, it's like the worst of both worlds.
Yeah.
You're going to be corrupt.
Yeah, like, that's what I'm saying, and I don't quite understand why. I guess it's just like, well, this whole thing isn't working, so we'll just try a whole other thing, even if it potentially is worse. That just seems like a weird... Again, you're going through it on a national level right now, and I mean, you've been traveling the country. It sounds like you were saying earlier. Do you talk to people about what's going on in their regions? And do you say, like, can you believe this is what is happening? Do you have a sense of that, having traveled and hit the road? Like, what's going on?
Well, what you do is when you travel in a band, you're not really. You're kind of living in a bubble, so you're going to meet like-minded people wherever you go. There's not going to be an ardent Trump supporter coming to a punk show, for instance. You know, maybe guys that used to go to punk shows turn into those kind of guys, but you get the feeling like everyone's kind of like what used to, when he first started running, you know, it was just met, you know, at least from my friends in my social circle, with like hearty laughter. And now, as it's going on, like, it's turning into chuckles, and then kind of you know, kind of a, you know, the laughter is getting more and more hollow as it's going on. Like, is this even possible? You know, and I think a lot of younger people I know who haven't lived as long as me, they only have lived in a world where it's been like they have vague memories of George Bush the second being president, and they have all these memories of Obama, so they don't know that, they don't know how it works, you know. So it's like for them, it's shocking that, you know, the candidates that we might end up having are going to be terrible people.
It does seem that even seasoned observers like yourself, I mean, you're an older person. Right. It does seem like a lot of people are taken aback by this. Are you surprised that this is happening?
No, I mean, because it seems like this goes back, you know, throughout the history of America, is that, I mean, the reason why Trump is so big is it's people trying to hold on to this idea of, you know, the big rich white guy taking care of everything. And like a lot of people are saying that it's like the last gasp of like the kind of people that believe in like white supremacy in America. You know, they don't, nobody likes change. Like, let's not just throw it at the feet of, you know, old white people, you know, but change is, you know, is scary and frightening, and you want to hold on to something. And I think a lot of it is just that he's a celebrity, and we're a very celebrity driven society, and he's got name recognition.
Right.
You know, I mean, people will be like, oh, Trump, I used to watch his TV show. He's a funny guy. They're not even, you know, to them, the president is a kind of a meaningless concept. You know, for a lot of Americans, it is. It just doesn't seem to affect you.
Right.
In a lot of ways. You know, it's just like, oh, who's this? You know, it's kind of like voting for who's your favorite celebrity. You know, and so it's going to be weird if it's going to be Hillary against Trump, because I can kind of consider them more as concepts than actual people at this point.
Right.
And I think that's what, you know, what it's going to come down to. And it will be interesting to see. It's one of those things where when you're young, you don't think that you're living through history. It's just when you get older, you kind of realize, oh, yeah,
right, a lot exactly. Can still happen. Yeah. It seems very immediate now, but in 3 months or 2 months, in just a few weeks, it could be completely different.
Right.
Yeah. Now, your state of Michigan, I mean, my perception of Michigan, I've been to Michigan many times. I find that the political spectrum seems rather complicated. You mentioned that at the state level, it's mostly run by Republicans, but there are lots of like really progressive pockets of Michigan. I've not experienced them, but I've seen some films, mostly by Michael Moore, that suggest there is a militant right-wing aspect to the state. And a lot of this might be true of many states. They're multifaceted. But what is your what is your perception of the state of Michigan, having lived there your whole life?
You know, it seemed like when I was younger, maybe I was just naive, it seemed like we were kind of a progressive state. Like, if we were putting in Republicans, they'd kind of be like fiscal Republicans and not like, you know, moral majority, you know, Christian right kind of Republicans, you know. But I think over time what happens, like, I know on the west side of the state, there's a lot of Calvinists, there's a lot of, you know, it's kind of a more religious, white religious area, and that's kind of been they've been kind of running the state government for a long time. And it's funny because, like, the other day someone was like, well, you know, you have this Snyder that's won governor two times, like, who were the Democrats that were running against him? And I couldn't remember their names. So it's not like the guys that are running against these Republicans are very good. You know, it's like we have a very weak Democratic slate on, you know, on the state level. But I think that's kind of the true in a lot of states. I mean, I was surprised that we were on tour down in Texas, and we were getting driven around by an Uber driver or somebody. He's like, oh, Michigan, that's the state that loves Bernie. And I didn't realize that, like, we had voted for Bernie Sanders in the... you know, so it's like we have strains of it, like, just, you know, because we are what it is, you know, because we were a labor state for the longest time, you know, and so the labor unions have been chipped away for the last 30, 40 years, so it's kind of, like, diminishing, but we were, you know, a pretty democratic state for a long time.
Right.
At least, you know, when it comes to, like, voting for, you know, union ideas and things like that.
Are you as surprised by the upswell for Bernie Sanders?
I am. I think, you know, I kind of look at it. It's one of those things where I wonder if it is not to knock down the people that won. You know, it would be interesting if he actually won the nomination. But it kind of reminds me of, like, when people wanted to vote for Nader years ago, where it's another thing where it's like, oh, this guy's like saying everything I believe in, but you know, I think, especially like on something like Facebook where all your friends kind of are like-minded people, it seems like it's almost a bubble of like, Bernie can do anything. It's like, well, you know, not a lot of people know who Bernie Sanders is.
Yeah, he doesn't have the name recognition, you know, somehow.
He doesn't have the money behind him, you know, and you have to kind of admit at first before like a candidate like him can win, you have to kind of change how elections are done with all the money.
Right.
You know? I think just because he doesn't have enough money is one of the reasons why his name's not out there and why people don't know him and why, you know, again, I think it comes down to let's vote for the celebrity and I know who Hillary Clinton is.
Right. You know, it's funny that you invoked Ralph Nader because in the year 2000, yeah. I was on tour with a band across the states from Canada. They were called Royal mm-hmm. City, and by the end of the tour, we were in Michigan. And I, in Nashville, had picked up a Ralph Nader for President button. And okay. on Saturday or Sunday, what day is the Detroit Farmers Market open?
Saturdays? I don't know. I don't really go down there. I think it's Saturdays. It's like all
Oh, is it? Okay. So yeah. one morning we were up and I was wearing my button and a guy screamed at me, You're costing us the election. You're costing us the election. And I had to scream back, I don't even live here.
I think it's a cool button. Leave me alone. Yeah. Well, and I think that's why I give Bernie Sanders credit, because he could easily have run as a third party candidate, you know. But he chose to go through the Democratic Party. You know, he's an independent, really.
Oh, that's a good point. Yeah,
I think he didn't want to Nader the election. You know, so I think he kind of wanted to work through the system, and so that's why, you know, I didn't want to compare him directly to Nader, but like, because he, yeah, Nader, like everybody was, yeah, Nader's great, but really he did kind of siphon off. You know, I don't think. Was it Gore? I don't think Gore would have won anyway.
Well, he would have won. I mean,
then there was the hanging chads and all that. Yeah, wait a minute. You did cost us the election.
I did cost you the election. I'm sorry. I left.
Someone saw that button and they're like, I'm going to vote for
the Green Party. Seemed to make sense. I liked Ralph Nader. I was a big fan of his as a kid. And then, yeah, I don't know. Yeah. I mean, again, this must be. Are you in a situation where the like, I don't know you very well. I know your music. I don't know you at all, frankly, but I know your music. Is Sanders someone you are the most in line with politically, socially?
Well, at first I should say right off the bat, we've been talking politics. I'm not much of a political person.
You fooled me.
I don't want, because, it's one of those things where I believe in politics on a local level. But if it's somebody that I can't go to their office and knock on their door, then it's kind of beyond me.
Okay.
It's beyond
my
scope. You know, so it's... you know, of course, yeah, I would think. But again, I'm like, you know, I would consider myself, I mean, I don't even know. But like, I like a lot of his ideas, but I wonder, it's almost like if we could combine, like, I almost wish that Hillary, like, when he does, and I don't think he's going to get the nomination, but when he does, you know, Hillary would be smart to like, okay, he's my vice president.
Right, that's what people are speculating.
You kind of hope that would happen, but and people were telling me I'm stupid for thinking that, it never happens. But... you kind of like the idea of like, okay, let's try to combine these things, and people obviously respond to his message and like what he's pushing, and maybe that would kind of be, you know, combining the two would make the candidate that, you know, would be all, you know,
right.
All inclusive.
I gather that your father was politically minded. Do you have a sense of what he might have thought of what's going on right now and where he?
My dad, he was completely unpolitical.
Oh, is that right? Okay.
Yeah, but he would have, you know, he knew because he worked at the water department that something shady was going on because, you know, and so, but I think he was kind of world weary, you know. He just kind of figured like, okay, you know, put your head down and work a job for as long as you can and enjoy your family. Like, if the world outside is one thing, and if you think about it too much, it's really going to, you know, put a strain on you.
Right.
You know, and this, if you want to do good in the world, you want to make change, you know, look outside your window. You know, don't try to geopolitical things. Like, it's one thing he always said is that whenever people talk about conspiracy, and they refer to like these grand conspiracies where everybody's working in tandem against you, he's like, always remember that those are people too, and they're just like you. But there's no grand conspiracy. It's just people going after things that, you know. There's no secret societies. I mean, there are, but like, there's no like grand scheme of things. It's just kind of people going after their own desires, you know.
Right. So. Right. Okay. Now you are I'm curious about the state of Detroit right now. How is Detroit doing? Because over the last few years, we've gathered that it hasn't been doing very well. What's your take on it at this point?
Well, you know, we're kind of in a weird spot now where civic boosters are telling us everything's going great. And we are seeing changes to things. I mean, there are, like, on the first album, I complained that our street light was burnt out for years, and now we have a new street light.
Right.
And so there's some things happening. There's definitely kind of an upswing. But I'm a little bit worried about the kind of trumpeting of certain things, and I'm worried that the focus is on the downtown area and on, you know, people moving into Detroit, and that they're getting catered to, while the people actually live in the neighborhoods are kind of getting forgotten. So it's kind of like trickle-down economics, in a sense, where, you know, maybe if we make, you know, downtown great, it'll help everybody else.
They're gentrifying the downtown in hopes that...
Right.
Okay.
And I always said Detroit was big enough that it's a big enough city that it can survive some gentrification. Like, I'm not one of those people that think, like, Detroit does not deserve, like, a rich part of town. That's fine, you know, but it's like when it seems like they're just trying to build a playground for the suburbanites and the newly arrived that seem to not have jobs, that seem they can, like, ride bikes around all day, and, you know, that's, like, I'm worried about that, but I understand that's kind of a universal thing. I just noticed from touring, you go to any city, I've been touring enough where you see that these kind of gentrification changes are happening to every American city, and they're all the same.
Yeah.
And that's worrisome, where, you know, every city used to have, like, a flavor to it, and I worry that this kind of, like urbanization, like, oh, we have to live in an urban environment, is really turning the downtown areas or the of every city into, like, the new suburbs. And it's very cookie cutter. You know, you might have a artisanal coffee shop, but it's going to be the exact same thing in any city you go to.
Yeah, it seems like the cookie cutter has gotten a bit cutesier and fancier. It does seem like they got wise to the fact that everyone was like, hey, all these big box stores are turning every city the same.
Right.
But now you're right. Like, they're trying to do these artisanal places, but they're still the same. Like, they're the same ones in every city. So
right.
I can't. It's like they got a little more clever about it and tried to, you know, strike that individualistic nerve. You know what I mean? And try to make us feel like we're independent, but it's really all the same. And that's kind of more insidious, actually, because you can't even tell.
Yeah. It's like one of those things where it's like, you're an individual, you deserve this $9 burrito. That is really a funky in this funky place where there's no uniforms, but then you look and you're like, okay, yeah, it's just kind of the new way to sell you something, and I don't mind that. I mean, like, I love a $9 burrito just like the next guy, but I just wish, like, in a place like Detroit that has, like, this rich history and has people living, like, the worst thing ever, and people are hopefully getting wise to this, is you get people saying, and usually they're not from Detroit, they're from, you know, one of the West Coast or East Coast, they say, I came to save Detroit. And it really comes across almost like, people, yeah, it's this weird sort of complex, like, if I come there with my new app, I'm going to, like, save Detroit. Or if this guy, this idea that they're settling Detroit. You know, Detroit's already been settled. I mean, there's room for everybody. We have plenty of room, but don't kind of come in and think that you're the first person that's ever set foot on the street or something. And that's kind of, you know.
Do you think the media is to blame for that? There's this sense, like, the images we see of Detroit are a hollowed-out city.
We could use the tax base. You know,
sure.
We could take your money. That's great. But when I first started touring, and I first started, like, just being a roadie, sort of, I was basically a friend that this band Tyvek would take me around. Mm-hmm. I was able to go with them on tour, and that was great. And so I got to see, you know, go every place. And people back then were like, oh, I heard Detroit's, like, a very violent city. And it is, but that was, like, kind of the main thing. Like, oh, you guys are from Detroit. It must be really tough. And now when I go around, I hear Detroit's great for artists.
I'm hearing that too. Yeah.
Right, and you can buy a house for like $5, and it's like you could, but the house would have no pipes. You'd have to pay a shit ton of back taxes, and you're going to be in one of the worst neighborhoods in Detroit.
Right.
So, have at it. But it's like, yeah, it's just kind of the attitude that you're going to come and, you know, I don't know. And it's also like, yeah, it's the media, but it's also kind of like, you know, the lazabout artist that's looking for a cheap place to live. And it's great because, you know, it's a lot of exciting things can come from that, but... you know, it's an actual city. It's not just the new campground to move into, in a sense.
You're hoping for, you mentioned the tax base. I mean, there's obviously infrastructure issues that are not going to be resolved by people paying cheap rent.
Right, right. And the number one thing people are moving here. What jobs are they getting? And are these jobs that people that lived in Detroit could have had? Or are they kind of like, I have a feeling that like a lot of them are like, tech jobs that, you know, well, like for years in Detroit, like when I graduated from college, no one I knew that was from Detroit except for a handful of people would go back to Detroit. I was one of the dumb few.
Right.
Most people moved to Chicago or New York looking for jobs. It just wasn't like kind of, if you were a college educated person, there wasn't those kind of jobs in Detroit. And so I kind of wonder now, are there more of those jobs coming to Detroit? Is it all just like a show? I can't tell.
Well, that's kind of interesting that you're there and you can't tell.
I mean, there's a lot more young people. And I think there is, I know Quicken Loans moved to downtown Detroit, and I know a ton of people that work there. But that's kind of like, oh, you're working for like a place that gives out loans.
Right.
To who?
Right.
And what are they paying? You know, like it's kind of like this kind of weird cycle. I don't know.
You mentioned that your city has a rich history. It has a rich musical history. It has a tremendous that music has a tremendous worldwide influence, and it runs the gamut from underground garage rock and punk to Motown and pop. How has the city's music history impacted you personally? Is there a way to encapsulate that?
I would say right off the bat, I didn't really know about, you don't really know about your own city's musical history. Like it took me well into my 20s to kind of realize that like Detroit was kind of a special place for music because you just, you know, you figure everywhere you go, there you are, you know, there's going to be like, I've said this before that, you know, I liked Motown growing up, but it was everywhere, you know, it'd be like if you're waiting in the dentist's chair, you'd be hearing Motown. If you know the car commercials had Motown, so you didn't really realize it had such an international effect. You know, Motown was just a shitty museum, you know, down the street. But now I can appreciate like, oh, it's a really great museum because it's just a house,
right.
You know, and all that music came out of just a house. And you know, you don't. I, you know, it's one of those things where you go to every town and it's kind of that. It's only like when we first went to Europe where you kind of get the feeling, oh, these people are coming to see us because it says we're from Detroit. And people are really invested outside of Detroit in Detroit music.
Right.
You know, it's a little bit different in Detroit. What makes Detroit great is there's places to play. It's a scene of people that like to have a good time and will be supportive of you. But it's better be a cheap show because if you're charging more than $5, no one's going to show up.
There are certain cities because of their geographic location that feel shut out from touring circuits. Mm-hmm. Like a city like Halifax, it's still like if a band comes to Halifax or St. John's, Newfoundland in Canada, people are very appreciative of that. But Detroit is always busy, right? People are always coming to Detroit.
Yeah, but we always get them on weekdays. Because they're either going to play Chicago on a weekend and they're heading to Toronto or, you know, and for a while, especially after 9/11, when the borders got really tough to cross, people were to skip Detroit.
Oh, right.
Yeah. And we still kind of get that sometimes where like people will play Chicago and then play Cleveland and it's like, okay, well you skipped us.
Right.
So we did get that. We were kind of isolated and have been, you know, where people would come. It seems like, from my limited knowledge of musical history, it seems like in the 60s and 70s, it would be like a really big rock and roll market, so every band would have to play there in Detroit. Now it's less so, I'd say. I think people, you know, because maybe rock and roll isn't so lucrative, people, you know, can skip Detroit.
Were there artists who visited Detroit and whose shows you went to that had an impact on you? And I only ask this because I don't know if there's any chance you were there. But for instance, I went to a show in Detroit in 1998 that was at the State Theater, which I think it has a different name now.
No, it's the Fillmore, yeah.
That's right. And it was Blonde Redhead, Shellac, and Fugazi. Were you there?
I was not at that one. I did see Blonde Redhead at the Shelter once, like around that same time.
Okay.
And they were the headliners then. That was done, and the Shelter is below St. Andrews.
Oh, okay.
And the Shelter would be like where I'd go see shows like in high school. It's famously in the 8 Mile movie is where they had the final rap battle.
Oh yeah, that's right. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Okay. Yeah, yeah.
So it's like it was a, you know, that like the St. Andrews and the Shelter were like kind of like where you'd go to see in the basement, like the weird shows, like the touring weird shows, and like where you go see like punk and those kind of things if you were a kid, because those were like usually all ages shows.
Okay.
Yeah, but that I remember seeing Blonde Redhead there, and I remember seeing like the Headcoats there, and you know, lots of shittier punk bands. that would be like, yeah, that'd be a place. And then there'd be like other, like Zoot's Coffee House later on would be like the place where you see kind of local weird bands, and like local like or weird touring bands like the Makeup or something would play like Zoot's Coffee House.
And was that impactful for you to have these people come into Detroit?
Well, again, at the time, I'm like, oh, this band that I got into a month ago is coming through town. This is great. and what I liked about Zoot's is like, if you go there now, like, Zoot's is no longer there, but like that neighborhood used to be, it was like the Cass Corridor, and anybody old enough has like a scary story about the Cass Corridor. I mean, it was a rough and tumble place. It was a rough and tumble place when my dad moved here in the 50s. And now it's really starting to change. I mean, that's where like the Third Man record store is,
right?
And Third Man's right next to Shinola, where they're selling like $500 sweaters and things like that. So it's like that neighborhood really is changing a lot. But when I was a kid, I remember going down there. And, you know, I'm from Detroit. I've been in Detroit my whole life. But I remember going to that part of town. I was like, this is a scary part of town, you know. And then there was another place right around the corner that was just like a box room, and that's where like hardcore bands would play. And I wasn't too much into hardcore, but occasionally I'd go to see shows there too. But I wasn't much of a showgoer in my younger days.
No, okay, you didn't. What did you spend your younger days doing instead of going to shows?
Staying at home and crying. No, watching a lot of movies. I was kind of a movie guy.
Oh, really? Do you have particular filmmakers or particular films?
I went to school for film, and unfortunately it was right on the cusp where we were still learning how to tape film together.
Uh-huh.
And then right after, like, I remember they were like, hey, check out DVDs or this new thing. You know, it was just coming, like, when I was in college, and, like, digital editing and that sort of thing. I would bore you with all, like, oh, all the greats.
No, yeah, sure, sure. No, I just, yeah. I wonder, because I wonder if that kind of stuff, it probably informs your voice as a songwriter on some level,
sure.
Right?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, yeah, yeah. I definitely, yeah, I try to, on certain songs, I'm like, okay, I picture it before I write it, you know, as far as, like, visuals.
Right.
And things, yeah.
Okay. Now, you earlier you mentioned something that I thought was interesting. You mentioned that your dad was somewhat world weary, and I think some people have thought that about you and right. Your aesthetic, so I don't know if it's a family trait. I feel like some people, we've talked a lot about hard stuff so far, and
right.
I feel like some people are less surprised by bad news than others.
Sure.
do you consider yourself more of a pessimist or an optimist? Does bad news actually surprise you?
Well, it's kind of this weird, like, when I say my dad was world, it wasn't like, you know, it wasn't like this house was full of depression. He was a very up fella.
Sure,
you
sure.
Know? And I like to think I'm the same way. It's just that, you know, when bad things happen, you don't pull your hair out over it. I mean, you kind of know that that's, like, the way the world works, and you just kind of get down to what you can do.
Right.
You know, it's not like, I mean, I'm trying to think about it. Like, I don't know if it was like the Irish thing or the, you know, what the influence was, or, you know, kind of in a weird way being kind of a minority growing up in Detroit, or what, you know, what the, where all like my personality comes from. But it's just kind of like, you know, don't be too big on yourself. You know, be nice to people, and, you know, don't Yeah, don't tear your hair out. Don't cry about it.
Please. Well, yeah, and that there's you're almost quoting one of your own lyrics right now. I just mm-hmm. noticed, but there's a thing that you do, it seems, with darkness, which is to find the humor in it. Humor sure. seems to be a big part of how you deal with that stuff.
Yeah.
And I don't know if that's, you mentioned some cinematic influences, but
sure.
is comedy a big thing for you? Like, are you a particular fan of particular comedians or kinds of comedy?
Well, just to go back, like, to the film thing, like, you know, not to, I feel like, kind of pretentious, but, like, at a young age, I was like, okay, the Coen brothers, I like, you know, the fact that they're funny, but then they also do, like, these kind of very, not dark, but, you know, like, the Inside Llewellyn Davis or whatever was really about failure,
right.
in a sense, and you don't often see a movie that's about a main character dealing with failure. And there's not like a happy ending, but it's not like a depressing ending, you know. It's not like a Lars von Trier movie where it's just piling up the depression.
Sure.
You know, it's like everybody can go through this, you know. You can be very talented and be very good at what you do and not reap the rewards, you know, that life is supposed to offer you or you think life is supposed to offer you. So like the Coen brothers, I like kind of their tone. Even, you know, there is like a lot of laughs in that movie, but it's also like almost a masterpiece of failure. And you know, like in Fellini movies are often there's funny stuff, but a lot of them are very dark themes about, you know, death and accepting things. And so yeah, but humor's got to be there. I mean, I'm not a goth. I'm a stretch of the imagination.
Sure, you know, sure.
Right. I mean, it just seems like, you know, I hate TV shows or something where someone's like, let's say they're a crime fighter or they're fighting crime, and there's never a moment of frivolity.
Yeah.
You know, even throughout the day, you know, you're gonna, even the sternest person is gonna find something funny. You know?
Well, to not and do that is to shut off a human dynamic, isn't it?
Right. Right. Yeah. It just seems unnatural to me, or not right. reality.
Okay. You know? Now, I had mentioned that the age mm-hmm. and intellect led to Protomartyr kind of breaking through last year, and I don't know if you mm-hmm. want to dispute that, because I know that people have different interpretations of what breaking through means. How would you right. characterize the moment your band seems to still be having? It seems to have started with this record in particular, but there was something building over the last record too. But this,
sure.
you know what I'm talking about. New York Times, blah blah blah. Like, there
right.
seem to be more people who are in positions of whatever power or mainstream, you've gotten more attention. Mm-hmm. How would you characterize this?
Well, it's when people start assuming that your life is different, you know, when they start saying, how are you handling this? And it's then you start thinking, how am I handling this? Because it's very intangible, you know. It's not like I'm getting a paycheck slipped through the door every day, you know. It's still kind of the same but bigger. I mean, I would say that I can definitely appreciate it and feel that we're lucky in the fact that now when we go to some place like Fargo, for instance, there's actually people there to see us. You know, we've done tours before where people like maybe vaguely know who we are, or and those are only 15 people. And now, like, you know, the crowds have gotten better, or as far as like knowing who we are.
Sure. But do you think that people have a mistaken presumption about what media coverage means?
Meaning, yeah, I think, yeah.
Do you know where I'm going with this?
Sure. Where they assume that, yeah, because you get good reviews, that somehow like changes, like number one, like your success. Like, does that equal success, or does that lead to like monetary or rewards? And it doesn't. I mean, it's always great that I think when more people have the opportunity to hear your stuff, but it really hasn't changed my life, except now I can't have a job because we're touring so much.
Yeah.
And the reason we're touring so much is so we can have enough money to not work, and we figure like a band that releases music and doesn't tour like a dog doesn't kind of deserve to be considered a good band, in a sense.
Is
you
that
know what I mean?
Yeah, I do know what you mean.
Yeah.
I can see why this is what you'd prefer to be doing.
Right, yeah. I mean, we want to do it. You know, it'd be nice if I could fart out a record and sit in a barca lounger and have money, you know, shooting to my face, but that's just not that's not how it works. And there was a funny moment where we were in Europe someplace, and I forget the fellow what band it was. He's just like, we were kind of standing by the merch area and people buying t-shirts and things, and he's like, yeah, you know, I really got into music to sell clothing. But that's really what you end up doing as a band, is like really your only tangible, like, okay, we're making money, is how many shirts you sold.
Yeah,
that's, you know, that's it. Not how many records, you know, because the records, usually you have to buy them from the record company to resell them. And I've yet to receive any money from like a Spotify or something, so I don't know if that, you know, yeah. You know, and then on then there's things like YouTube where people can listen to your whole record, and you're kind of wondering, like, is this illegal? Should I tell them not to do it? Like, I don't, you don't know, because you're not getting any money from that. So you don't know if you're successful or not until you have to print out new t-shirts, really.
That's right, you know. Because the t-shirt sales would also suggest that more people are coming to the shows.
Right, yeah, they're coming to the shows, and perhaps they've either bought your record before, or maybe they illegally downloaded it, you know, who knows. But they're coming to your show, and they're buying your t-shirt, and you think, okay, and you don't want to become a t-shirt band, but you do want to, you know, go to the next town and have some money for food. So that's kind of what you got to do.
This does explain the excitement I have been hearing from people who do merch and come screaming at the band, hey, we sold 30 t-shirts.
Yeah, no, because you can immediately, you think to yourself, okay, well, last night we only sold 15.
Right.
This is a good, yeah, and you're kind of doing this calculations, and, you know, then you have the amount of, like, emails we get, like, hey, can I buy a t-shirt and not go to the show? And, you know, for a long time, like, no, like, we'll never sell stuff online. It's stupid, you know, the t-shirts are for people that come to the show and come to see us. But now that we don't have a job, like, when we're, like, if we have a break in touring, it's like, well, should we open a store and sell these t-shirts, you know?
Yeah.
So it's amazing how much clothing becomes, like, your main priority.
That is.
So that's, I guess that's a level of success. Yeah, like, it's not all about the music. It's the music and the t-shirts.
I've yeah. seen your band twice now, and it's yeah. very impressive. I really enjoy seeing it. But it also is quite enigmatic. In your stage presence, there mm-hmm. seems to be this collision of total commitment and passion with seemingly casual indifference to right. what you're doing. And I'm wondering, are those things you're conscious of conveying? Is that just who you are?
The indifference is definitely a byproduct of me not knowing what I'm doing. And I kind of want to keep it that way. Like, I don't ever, like, it's nervousness and knowing, like, okay, I got a job where these people are coming to hear me, and I have moments where I'll be in a van between shows and kind of, like, think to myself, holy shit, Joe, you're a singer in a band. And I'm like, wait a minute. No, I kind of, like, have, like, a shocking, you know, so it's like, okay, I have to perform these songs, and I don't know how to do it, so I have to figure out how to, like, each night I have to kind of redo it, you know.
Is the indifference a defense mechanism then?
The indifference is just, like, knowing, like, turning off the part of your brain that's like, I gotta entertain these people, you know, I gotta dance,
right.
You know, I gotta do something, I gotta hold the mic a certain way. It's trying to figure it out as it's happening, and it's kind of like my, I think what people are seeing is actually the gears in my brain kind of turning very slowly, like, oh, okay, you know, but also trying not to screw up a song, and like, okay, I've got how many seconds before I can drink a beer here, I think. Oh, here comes the next part I have to sing.
You've got a lot of stuff to really think about as the front guy, yeah.
Well, it's weird, yeah. I wish I could turn my brain off, and so, yeah.
Where did your drive to perform come from? Like, do you have any history of public speaking or presentation?
None at all. I was talking to a friend who I met after years of, she was a camper at a summer camp that I worked at, where I was, like, for the year that she was there, I was, like, the programs director. So I'd come out every morning, like, hey, kids, and welcome to camp. And it's funny thinking about myself now, like, 20 years, that was 20 years ago, where I was kind of like the showman for this group of, like, 50 kids. That's it, though. And then for the next 20 years, I didn't do anything. So it's mostly just, like, you just, I was basically like, I keep on saying this time and time again, but it's this truth is that I toured with the band Tyvek, and they're good friends of mine, and I saw how much fun they were having, and I was like, oh, I could probably do that, and that could be something I could do. And it was kind of like after my dad died, I was like, Joe, you're in your mid-30s now. This is getting ridiculous. Either you better do something, that, you know, because for years I'm like, oh, I'm an artist. Oh, I'm a writer. Oh, but I never would write. I'd never, like, do any art. I was like, okay, Joe, you either got to do it now or get a job and just, you know, stop, you know, lying around and doing nothing. So being in a band was kind of, okay, I could do art and I could write and I might as well do it, but I shouldn't put too much stock in it because I'm not very good at it. But luckily, I met the band, and they were like nice enough to put up with me.
I presume you're somewhat surprised at how much what you're doing is resonating with people.
Yeah, I mean, because like there's so many bands in Detroit that are just as good, if not better, than us. You know, have like better chops, have a better singer. But it's more, I think it's dumb luck. It's we met the right people at the right time, and that we actually can tour, which a lot of bands can't do. And so that's why, like, the grind of touring is like something that there's enough joy in it that it's worth it, you know. But you have to approach it as this is a job. It's not like a vacation.
Right. Yeah, you're not really traveling. When you say you live in a bubble on the road, it's really true.
Yeah. Oh, no. Yeah, we could go to Rome and not see Rome at all. You know, you could go to, like, we went to Paris once, and the first time we went to Paris, we were kind of like on the outside of it. We went, the great thing about Europe is they always have to give you a place to stay, so we had a hotel. The hotel, we walked from the hotel to the show, played the show, walked back. Next sun comes up, we have to drive out. So we saw really nothing of Paris.
And that's the reality, and, you know, yeah.
Yeah, and people their whole life, you know, before I was in a band, like, oh, I would love to see Paris, you know. So I'll never go to Paris, you know. And you get to go, but you don't get to see it.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah. So. Well, hopefully you can. Yeah. Did you like going to Paris, or?
There's like some sort of syndrome. I don't know the exact name of it, where people think of Paris in a certain way. I think it's like mostly Japanese. Like I think it's like a Japanese concept, where they had this. Concept of Paris is like the city of lights and the city of romance, and they get there and they see all the dog shit on the ground, and they see like how it's just like any other city but with like a couple pretty parts, and they get like massively depressed because it's almost like that's like the dream is to go to Paris and eat a baguette and, you know, see a mime, and then when they get there it's like not like that at all, and they're like, oh, my life. So I want to avoid that. So
you're you know, I think a very personal writer, but you're very artful about it, and we live in a very direct, accessible time when it comes to relationships between public creators and their audiences. Do you actually enjoy the interaction with strangers who are processing you and your work?
Most of the time, like I try to not have like a internet presence as much as I can. Like where I'm like, hey, let me tell you, you know, and I'm still getting used to the idea of like going to a show and having people say, hey, Joe. And so I turn around thinking, okay, this is somebody I must have met before because they know my name. And then it kind of clicking like, no, they know me because I'm the lead singer of the band that's performing.
Weird,
tonight.
Right? That's a weird,
Right, it is, I always get frustrated when there's three people that want to talk to me, or not even talk to me, just say, hey, man, great job. And I go, oh, thank you very much. And then someone else says, oh, great job. And say, oh, thank you very much. And I'm like, why am I doing it the same way? Like, I should give each person something personal, and like, because, you know, they're going out of their way to say I did a good job. You know, and I find myself, like, reverting to, like, the same thing. And that frustrates me, you know, because I don't want to be fake, but I don't, you know, it's kind of weird. It's one of those weird battles that's, I guess, nice to have.
To be fair to you, Joe, they're also all saying the same thing.
Yeah, yeah. Well, then sometimes I say something weird and it throws me off. I'm like, what? What did you say? You know, I said thank you very much. Now get out of here. Like, yeah. So, you know, it's one of those. It's a good problem to have being in a band. It's nice that people like you afterwards. You know, the people that don't like it don't come up and say, hey, really bad job tonight. You know, they just leave. You know, they leave in disgust.
There's a sense among some people who are fans of things that they might know the person creating the thing better than most people. I mean, in sure. some ways, you're conveying things in your songs that you would never convey to maybe your closest friend, right?
Right, right, yeah.
So
yeah.
on some and level, some of these people know you really well.
Right, and they are picking up on things that they should, and it's kind of one of those things where, you know, and I've had the same problem where, you know, I remember, you know, being fans of bands when I was younger, and you feel like, I really know Shane McGowan. I bet you if I met Shane McGowan, I'd really, you know, but would Shane McGowan want to talk to me? Probably not, you know. But so you kind of want to, you know, be there for people in a sense, you know. But when they really start talking your ear off, you have to kind of like, okay, you talk to me more than my friends talk to me. I have to leave now.
Have you yeah. had the chance to encounter people you admire since the band status has sort of risen in the last little while?
I've met Dave Thomas from Perubu, mm-hmm. and I didn't bother him at all. I tried to stay out of his way. And that was kind of, he seemed to live up to like what I thought he'd be like, and you know, irascible and a personality, and just like you know, besides that, not really. I like right now what I really like is from touring and going like South by. We just got back from South by Southwest, which is not much fun.
No, it's not. It's horrible. Sorry, I don't mean to disparage it for people who like.
Oh no, no, you're exactly right, but. What you do is you do that, and then you go to like one of the unofficial shows, or you hang out after it, and on the outskirts of the actual clusterfuck that is South by Southwest, there is, you do get to see friends from all over the world, you know, and so that becomes like, oh, I'm hanging, you know, I get to see this band, and I get to party with these guys, and it's just, it becomes, that's the good part, is you get to see. I like being in the group of current bands right now and meeting these current bands and comparing notes and like, how are you doing? And like, what did you do to do this? And you know,
right.
that to me is the best. I'd like to meet my heroes, but I think they're all going to let me down. So I'd rather like hang out with bands like, you know, the Cloud Nothing guys, what we're good buddies with now, and the Parquet Courts guys, and the Chastity Belt girls. We just went on tour with them. It's one of those things when it was the first time we toured with them, like the first day we're kind of like awkward around each other, and by the end of it we're like, we're best friends. You know? So like those kind of things is like, you know, contemporaries is what I get a kick
yeah,
out of,
I can see right that. Now. I can see that. Now when you do mm-hmm. interviews or discuss the band publicly, do such things prove to be instructive in your understanding or appreciation for this band?
No, I mean, because I think it's still... It's still the same. I mean, we did like this week. I don't know if I can say what it's for, but we came back from South by Southwest on Sunday, and we have to come up with a song by tomorrow. We're recording it tomorrow, and it was almost like we're sitting down in the basement, like, all right, we gotta come up with a song. Like, and I think we're all worried for a moment, like, can we do it again? Like, do we have, you know, especially the clicking clock, you know, clicking, a ticking clock. Yeah. And then we just, all of a sudden, you know, we kind of locked into the old way of doing things. And it sounds like the song we're recording tomorrow is going to be insane and fun. And so it's like, okay, yeah, like that doesn't, the outside world doesn't affect it. It's still going to be another terrible Proto Mother song.
Is
you know,
it?
Done the way it's always been done.
You know, so external stuff isn't impacting the way you two, or rather your band works together and functions.
Right. No, not one bit. You know, and so that's good. Like the actual core band dynamic has not changed, and the way we go about the business amongst ourselves is not changed. And in fact, some of the perks of being a slightly bigger band have actually kind of helped us.
Right.
Like we now can, because we're playing certain shows, we can afford someone to drive and be a tour manager, and that is like a godsend, I think, for any band, because before we'd always have to pick like who's going to be the guy that drives
right.
today, and they become the de facto leader within the band, and that's always like a trouble, because like, let's say I want to hang out and talk to somebody for a while, and that guy's going to be like, no, we got to go, you know. And then
yeah.
You're like, yeah, screw you, you're the bass player, or screw you, you're the drummer, I'm the singer. It becomes like this weird, but when you have another guy, it's just the driver, then he can boss you guys around, and you're still the band, you're all together.
Yeah, that's true. You're absolutely right.
So that's just one of those things where, that is why you want to have a driver. You know? Before, I'd be like, no, we're a punk band. Like, we drive ourselves. But no, that really, it's going to save us in the long run.
It does help. Yeah, I can see that. I've road managed. I enjoy it. And it's fun bossing people around.
You're a godsend. Yeah.
this song, I know you can't talk about it. Is it an original song then?
Yeah.
Okay, I just wondered if it was a cover or something, but okay, cool, that's great. We'll hear it at some point.
I think there might be some saxophone on it.
Oh,
we're
okay.
We're inviting a bunch of friends just to come in and improve it, what we came up with in a week. So hopefully
nice. That's exciting. Yeah. Now you're playing some smaller markets. I noticed that, particularly in Canada. Was that your call or the agents? Like, are small markets important to you?
They are for us, and I know, like, and I think that's kind of, I think it's, it helps that our booker kind of knows what we like, and I think it's important to, you know, play the smaller markets, because, like, I know when we played Hamilton one time, they're like, oh, thank you so much for playing Hamilton and not just always going to Toronto.
Yeah.
You know, and like, yeah, of course, like, you know, it's, because I have the same feeling as kind of being in Detroit, even though it's like a bigger place. It's like, yeah, don't skip us. And I think we've had some of our best shows in some of our, you know, what we consider a smaller, we play like Fayetteville, Arkansas, and it was like one of the best shows we've ever played. It was like on a Sunday. It was a college town, but college was out, and it was on a Sunday. We're like, this is going to be terrible, and it was like one of our best shows.
Right. So it's people who aren't used to, I'm sure you've found this in a larger market like Toronto. They're spoiled. They're lousy with great shows.
Right.
Whereas I'm calling you from Guelph, where you're playing, and we have we have a lot of, it's a vibrant arts community, but we're all very excited that Proto Martyr is coming. I mean, the people who know the band are very stoked.
And then the people that don't know the band would be like, there's not much going on. Let's go see this show. Who cares? Let's have a good time.
Yes, exactly. They're appreciative that there's something going on. So
right. Whereas like in the bigger, like in New York, like, you know, it's great. We love playing New York. We, you know, we have a lot of great people there and fans, but there is the aspect of people coming in, tweeting about seeing the show and then going someplace else.
Right. So the people that for whatever reason, the smaller market. Well, no, we know why the smaller markets tend to care. There's passion there. So
right, and they also want to have a good time, and they're starved for entertainment too. That helps.
Now, do you know anything about Guelph?
Just that I'm always worried to pronounce it, that I pronounce it wrong. That's about it. I know roughly where it is.
Okay. It's a nice city. The Constantines are from, formed
here? Okay, now that rings, yeah. And that's, I think one time someone says, you guys remind me of a shittier Constantines. I was like, I'll take that. That's pretty good. that's a good, you know, you hit the nail on the head.
Are you actually a fan of that band?
It was one of those things where, like, one of my friends was like a huge fan, and then he's like, oh, you guys kind of sound like the Constantines. And I was like, oh, you know, I've never, like, I vaguely remember them, and I remember hearing one song that I like. I'm going to go back and listen to them. And I'm like, oh, this is really good.
Nice.
That's always the best when people try to compare you to something you haven't heard before, and you're like, I have to listen, you know, I have to check this out and see if we do.
Right.
And then it's always like, oh, this is great.
Oh, good. Well, I'm glad. Yeah, the comparisons come up a few times, and, you mentioned that you're recording the song tomorrow, and we've established there's a ton of tour dates. What else is coming up next for you and your band?
After this, we start a European tour next Tuesday. Then we come back and almost immediately do these Canadian dates in New England. Then I think we have a little bit, then it's just going to be all these festival dates.
Right.
Like in America, and also, we're playing Sled Island. And like, I'm looking forward to Sled Island. I think that's going to be, it seems like it's like, as far as festivals go, like a good
It's
one.
A wonderful, it's wonderful festival. Yeah. It's great. Yeah. I had a great time there. The one, I have only been once, but it was amazing. And the lineup this year is really bonkers. It's great.
Yeah. And so I'm looking for that. And then once all this touring is done, which it might not be done until like November, then the idea is that we start coming up with new stuff again. Because we're not a band that can come up with music on the road. Just because we kind of need to have the time to be embarrassed, you know, in front of each other. So we can't, like, you can't really do sound check. Like, let's work on a song. Because we hate sound. Like, sound check is, we don't hate it, but it's like something you have to get done with.
Right.
You don't want to, like, have the sound guy having to sit around. You know, you want to get it done. So we won't be able to write any songs until we get back in, I think, uh, October, November or something.
Okay.
And then plug away again.
Are you a guy that writes on the road, or do you write against the music? Like, does the music come first and then you start writing?
The music comes first, but like, I'll jot stuff down, but not like fully formed. Just kind of like, I'll have like a notebook that will... Well, I'm always worried. I think I told my friend that watches at my house when I'm gone. I'm like, if I die, burn all those books, because it will look like the rantings of a crazy person. Because there's no rhyme or reason. There's no... It's burn those. My magazine collection, burn all those.
What's in your magazine collection?
I'd rather...
Okay, yeah, right.
Old National Geographics, or 14 times. Yeah.
Well, I want to let people know, once again, the latest album by Proto Martyr is The Agent Intellect, which is out now via Hardly Art Records, and the band continues to tour extensively around the world, including upcoming Canadian stops in Guelph, Guelph, Ottawa, Guelph, Montreal, and Calgary. That's all throughout May and June. And for more information, people can visit protomartyrband.com or hardlyart.com. Joe, is there a song from The Agent Intellect that we can go out on?
I'm going to pick one that has been killing it on tour, and I couldn't be happier, because I think it's one that is my secret favorite, but it changes. But for right now, Clandestine Time is my go-to song on the album.
Do you have a sense of why it's killing it, so to speak?
I think it's because it's not... I think if for people that have only heard the singles or what's been released, and maybe not heard the album, it kind of comes as a surprise. And it comes near the end of the... Usually we put it near the end of the set, and we kind of let it all hang out on that one. And I do a lot of yelling. Because on the recorded version, I was able just to go... Like, use a lot of, like, studio trickery to kind of keep my voice going throughout the song.
Yeah,
and I can't, you know, we have not gotten to the point to have a sound guy on tour, so I have to figure out a way to do it, and the band just really puts their back into it on that one on live, but I think recorded it's a pretty song.
Okay.
And when we do it live, it punches you in the face.
All right, well let's punch some people in the face right now with this recorded recorded. Yeah, you know what I'm saying. This is Clandestine Time by Proto Martyr. Joe, this was a real pleasure. I hope you enjoyed yourself, and thank you for being on this show, and best of luck with everything.
Thank you.
Clandestine time. The small unseen things that do the job. While the minutes stick by, I did a bridge from life, falling into abstraction, and on the call, the proof we are here is the dust that they're breathing. See you.
That was Clandestine Time by Proto Martyr from their new album, The Agent Intellect. Special thanks to Joe Casey of the band Proto Martyr for being on the show and fielding questions that were likely out of his comfort zone, but he fielded them like a champ, didn't he? Michigan politics and whatnot. I didn't know where we were going to go with that. And if he had right at the beginning said, I don't know anything about that stuff, then I would have let it go. But he clearly knew a lot about it, and I found that very interesting. So thanks again, Joe. Proto Martyr are great. I've seen them a couple times. I love them. The records are all great. Go see Proto Martyr. They are on tour, actually, right now. Depending on where you're listening, they're in Europe all throughout March and April, and then they're back again in July. But in May and some of June, they are in North America, including Guelph. That's exciting. They're coming to the E-Bar in Guelph on May 3rd. So I don't have to go very far. That's right near my house. I'm excited to see Proto Martyr in my town. That's going to be fun. All right. Well, if you want to listen to Creative Control with Vish Khanna, it's on iTunes, audioboom.com, vishkhanna.com. There's a Patreon page for the show where you can make a flexible monthly donation to the program. Also, we're on Facebook. Creative Control with Vish Khanna is there on Facebook. We're on Twitter, at Vish Creative. I'm at Vish Khanna. You can listen to this show every Wednesday at noon Eastern Standard Time on CFRU 93.3 FM in Guelph or worldwide at CFRU.ca. We have lots of big events coming up. I urge you, again, if you're in the Toronto area, to come see me at the Spur Festival on April 8th at the Transac, and maybe even more significantly, at the Drake Underground to see me do a live podcast taping with Nathan Lore of the Minotaurs and Pia Chattopadhyay of CBC Radio. That show is presented by Massey Hall. They'd like to work with me, and I'd like to work with them, but there needs to be some ticket sales to justify that. So if you haven't yet, please do buy your tickets to that show April 9th at the Drake Underground at 8 p.m. And if you have any questions about that, contact creativecontrol933@gmail.com, and I will try to hook you up with a deal. Okay? All right, that's it for me. More shows to come, as always. Thanks for listening. Talk to you soon. Goodbye for now. Rest in peace, Gary Shandling. Miss you, buddy.